This week, sunrise will be at around 7 a.m. Sunset at 4:45 p.m. By midweek, temperatures will be at 11 degrees Celsius, with wind speeds decreasing to around 6 miles per hour.
This is the Sunwell News, due with you on the 25th of October for the blind and visually impaired community in and around Sunwell. And my apologies, by the way, for getting the sunrise time wrong last week. I was an hour out, but I think I've got it right this week.
Some highlights from the Express and Star, Wednesday, 15th October. I agree with Jenrick, says British Asian. Historic former industrial estate in Rolfe Street to be cleared to make way for 118 new homes. Rise in number of police officers stripped of their posts. Marston's believes in giving former prison inmates a second chance. Thursday's news. Pensioners warned about winter fuel scam messages. Unemployment figures in the West Midlands still the highest in the country. Friday's news. Four deny assisting murderer to evade the police, New Albion fan board. Saturday's news. Ticketless tap-in tap-out for trams will see end to conductors by end of the year. No appointment necessary podcast. Women's voices should be heard. Women's health is an everyone issue. Monday's news. Greg's to revamp Baggy's ground site. Have you got a cold or is it COVID? Man found dead in Worley Woods. Plan to convert derelict Great Bridge pub into shops, flats and an HMO. Tuesday's news. Albion's 2-1 victory over Preston North End. Bus and tram disruption in Broad Street and central Birmingham. Blind patient now able to read with an eye implant. Call to be considerate with fireworks.
All those stories and more coming up courtesy of Express and Star Publications. And along the way, the usual rundown of TV and radio listings from Talking News Federation. And a longish article from them too about Showdown, which is often listed in the SVI activities. And there'll be a short reminder of their upcoming annual forum on the 17th of November. So let's get straight on with this week's news taken from the Express and Star.
This is James Brodie bringing to you stories from the Express and Star dated the 15th of October. I agree with Jenrick when he says Handsworth is a problem. British Asian Roshan Dugg's assessment on ghetto area and its ethnic population. Robert Jenrick's visit to Handsworth and his reaction to it has created a national debate. Today's British Asian and proud Brummie Roshan Dugg explains why he agrees with the former Tory minister who raised concerns about the lack of white faces on the streets. Many will disagree with Mr. Dugg, but his argument is valid and we should encourage debate. Mr. Jenrick, a man who grew up in leafy Shropshire and went to Wolverhampton Grammar School, appeared condescending when he cast judgment on Handsworth. Mr. Dugg is part of the Birmingham community and he knows it well. He is concerned that there has been division, not integration, and the deterioration of a neighbourhood he cares about. He also rightly argues that there is nothing wrong in being concerned about issues around the culture and the country. Very few people in Birmingham would disagree with Robert Jenrick's comments about a failure of Liberal policies to integrate communities. Handsworth is not a place that anyone would describe as rich, harmonious or salubrious in any way. Unlike local councillors who have been in the media playing down any criticism of the place, many would consider Handsworth as one of the most socially and economically deprived areas in Britain. It is, after all, along with Toxteth and Brixton, one of the epicentres of the so-called race riots in the early 1980s. And in recent years it has become a magnet for all the migration refugees arriving from Eastern Europe, North Africa and the Middle East. In Handsworth, communities function in isolation to one another and not in conjunction with each other. Every now and again there are different factions that might collide, but they are not in union with one another. There is an array of languages and cultures and differing nationalities who, for the want of a better word, tolerate one another from afar. This is aided further by Gaza flags and a mile or two down towards West Bromwich, Union Jacks flying in lampposts, creating a distinct sense that we are living in a divided Britain. With the high influx of immigration arriving in the area, education and social services are at breaking points because of the growing demands placed upon them. All of this creating division and social and cultural suspicion, and this cannot be healthy or sensible or a way to create tomorrow's Britain. Handsworth is not as liberal as some local commentators have been saying, a utopia of communities cohesion or a model for other prospective multicultural areas. Walking through its high street, Soho Road, any sensible law-abiding person would feel a sense of alienation. Like other journalists visiting Handsworth, I too felt unsafe here, especially towards the evening. One feels a sense of threat and your personal safety is in danger. This isn't paranoia or xenophobia, but a strange feeling that although you're in England, you're remote from anything you would associate with the undefinable concept. Handsworth is in England and it does embody certain aspects of Englishness, but not as we know it. Yes, Handsworth history and architecture are remnants of the old era with Victorian houses, old churches and listed buildings. But that is fading away, replaced by countless gurdwaras and mosques. Local schools are proud to say that they have as many as 80 different languages spoken by their pupils, coupled with the ever-increasing foreign stores selling exotic foods and drinks, where local councillors are known to proclaim more support for Gaza and Palestine than they do for finding a solution to the continuing bin strike. You might be forgiven for thinking that you're in a foreign country. The truth is that Handsworth is problematic, alien and poverty-stricken, with a disproportionate amount of people on welfare and universal credit, school pupils receiving free school meals and sky-high crime. Understandably, it's also been where critics have described it as a white flight. White people leaving the area in droves. This has created a sense that different communities from all over the world living together without togetherness. But white British communities have been erased from the area. Almost completely, they have been compelled to leave. Robert Jenrick is therefore right. White British only come into the area to work, to drive through it as part of their commute. And if you stand for half an hour on the high street, an hour even, it's very unlikely that you will come across a white resident of the area. But then coupled with the surmountable rubbish and the bin bags strewn across the pavements, the occasional glimpse of scurrying rats and early morning presence of alcoholics and drug addicts, not to mention prostitutes, why would anyone want to go through this ghetto? The only people who have anything positive to say about it are local politicians who obviously have a vested interest. And liberals, neither of these groups actually live in the area, with local leaders and schools celebrating everything from other cultures in the way of arts, religious festivals, but feeling strangely queasy about flying the St. George's flag or marking Christmas, lest they offend a certain minority group. Is it any wonder that white British people feel that they are foreigners in their own country? In Handsworth, at least, they are a minority group. So what does this multiculturally and racially diverse area mean for our policymakers? Jenrick's comments raise questions not only about how many people Britain can accommodate, but how we assimilate people who are already here and how we can establish a sense of cultural identity and nationalhood, but just how effective are schools teaching of British values in spite of our teachers sneering at such topics. As an advisor to the government bodies, I believe politicians, educationalists and policymakers on both sides of the political spectrum have got to face reality and smell the coffee. Instead of regurgitating vacuous stuff about how effective multiculturalism is and how we love diversity, perhaps they should listen to supporters of the Reform Party and take on board their concerns in a meaningful way, instead of simply demonising Indigenous British people concerned about their culture and country. Perhaps then, by singing from the same hymn sheet, we might reach a solution that takes in the interest of all of our communities and not just those who we're providing a safe haven for. Roshan Doug is an education consultant, Birmingham Poet Laureate and Fellow of the Royal Society of Arts. Historic industrial estate to be demolished for 118 new homes. This story is brought to you by Christian Barnett. Supporting this article is a picture of the former Smethwick Enterprise Centre in Rolfe Street, Smethwick, which is set to be knocked down. The majority of a historic industrial estate in Smethwick looks finally set to be demolished for housing, 3 years after it was ruled surplus to requirements by a council. The ageing Smethwick Enterprise Centre in Rolfe Street, Smethwick, is set to be knocked down as part of a move by Sandwell Council that will eventually see up to 118 homes and flats built. Two blocks will be spared from demolition and the front Rolfe Street facade, and the industrial estates will be kept, as would the former fire station training tower. The council revealed in 2022 it was planning to demolish all of the buildings on the council-owned industrial estate, giving some of the remaining 35 businesses, which include a homeless charity, a long-standing engineering firm, a dairy company and a flooring business, just months to leave and find a new home. With the new site empty by January 2023, 1973, the council did put up forward its demolition plans, but the applications were met with objections over the damage it would cause to the area's heritage. The application received objections from Historic England, the Canal and River Trust, and the Victorian Society over the harm it would cause to the conservation area, and eventually withdrawn to allow for further talks. Whilst the individual buildings were judged to have little or no significance in heritage, reportedly the sites of the whole had a high degree of local significance because of its location within the conservation area and its position next to two listed buildings. However, the architectural quality of the buildings was generally low, the council added. The heritage assessment recommended that the new housing should be of a high quality that celebrates the industrial heritage of the site, with varying roof heights, footprints and placements of the buildings being carried out through to the new design for a housing-led scheme. A statement included with the council's planning application said due to the continued demise of the Enterprise Centre and investment required to refurbish the site, it became unsustainable and unviable to run. It has received funding from the government's Town Fund for demolition and remediation of the site in readiness for residential development. The project now proposes to retain a few buildings of the conversion along with a facade in order to retain some of the more significant heritage features to be included within the new development. Sandhill Council said repairing and refurbishing the site would have cost more than £3 million but would not guarantee the units would be occupied if the work was carried out. Knocking the building down to use this site for housing in the future was deemed to be more cost-effective and land-efficient option in the long term, the council said. A master plan for the regeneration of Rolfe Street, dubbed the biggest brownfield site in Europe, was backed by councillors 2 summers ago. As well as the hundreds of new homes, the master plan includes a public square, green spaces linking up existing canals in the area, and new connection points between the train station and the Midlands Metropolitan University Hospital. Sandwell Council said that the industrial site had been touted for housing as far back as 2008, and as a result of the regeneration, Rolfe Street was included in the council's plans when it bid for the town's funds money from the government. In all, Sandor was given £23.5 million, with £2 million going towards demolishing the Smethwick Enterprise Centre. The former industrial estate is a key location in the council's regeneration plans for the key Smethwick to Birmingham corridor. Sandor Council said that some of the units had not been appropriately maintained and had fallen below the standards considered suitable for rental. Before being kicked out by Sandwell Council, traders had complained about asbestos, rotting doors and rat infestation. They had also claimed to have witnessed dogs and ducks being shot. Because of this, two-thirds of the industrial estate was lying empty by 2019. The council said it was not receiving enough rent money to cover costs, and over time the buildings became dilapidated and the maintenance budget was not sufficient to make the necessary repairs. Rise in number of police officers stripped of post. This story is brought to you by Deborah Hardiman. New figures show almost 50 police officers were stripped of their posts at the West Midlands and Staffordshire Forces in the past year. West Midlands Police saw 37 officers sacked and barred from returning to the service in the year to March 31st, 2025, an increase of 8 on the previous year, while Staffordshire Police saw 10 dismissed in the same period, an increase of 6 on the previous year. The 47 were amongst 735 to be dismissed nationally, an increase of 24% compared to the previous year, according to the latest figures from the College of Policing. The College said that the most common reasons for dismissal was dishonesty, discriminatory behaviour, unlawful access of disclosure or information, inappropriate communications, and sexual offences or misconduct. Other cases involved abuse of position or sexual purpose, child sexual offences, being in a discriminatory WhatsApp group, domestic abuse or harassment, and drugs. Amongst those sacked during the period was former West Midlands Police Sergeant Andrew Grant, who was dismissed in June last year for making inappropriate and discriminatory comments about a transgender officer. Former Dudley-based Chief Inspector Banjil Sonal was also dismissed in June last year after his drunken behaviour on a plane resulted in it being removed from the flight in 2022. Last December, former Staffordshire Police Constable Lucy Rowe was relieved of her duties and placed on the barred list for failing to cease all contact with a member of the public whom she had been directed not to contact based on concerns of a conflict of interest. West Midlands Police Chief Constable Craig Guildford, also the National Police Chief's Council Lead Professional Standards, said the vast majority of police officers and staff serve the public with distinction day in and day out, regardless of the personal challenges that they can often face. Police chiefs are committed to rooting out the tiny minority who betray our professional standards and badly let the public and their colleagues down. Changes to misconduct regulations have helped policing to determine the facts of a case more quickly, to remove or sanction unless those guilty of serious gross misconduct, and exonerate the innocent. This data shows that where grounds have been met to carry out accelerated misconduct hearings, the overwhelming majority end in an expeditious dismissal, or would have ended in dismissal had the officer still been employed in policing. Whilst every example is uncomfortable and difficult, each action we take to detect and deter misconduct is a demonstration of our values, our intolerance of those who don't uphold them, and our unrelenting determination to uphold the highest standards of professional behaviour. Staffordshire Police declined to comment on its figures. Uni Event will launch scholarship fund in former student's name. Supporting the article is a picture of Susie and Owen Richards, with Joe in the middle, who was killed in a terrorist attack. A specialist university event will mark the launch of a new scholarship fund dedicated to the memory of former student Joel Richards. Held at the University of Worcester Arena's conference suite, named in Joel's honour, the evening will feature reflections in Walking the Camaro from University Vice-Chancellor Professor David Green. He recently completed the 280-kilometre from Porto to Santiago de Compostela along the world-famous Portuguese Camino to raise funds for the student scholarship and the hardship support. At the event from 7:30 on Thursday, November the 6th, he will share stories from his 14-day journey, including the motivations behind the walk, the people he met, and the fascinating experiences he had. Joel from Wensbury was a football referee and studying at the University of Worcester when, August the 19th, he became the youngest victim of the Tunisia Beach massacres in 2015. His uncle and grandfather were also murdered in the months following the attack. Joel's mother, Suzanne, established the charity Smile for Joel, alongside his brother, Owen, who was himself wounded in the attack and was described by the coroner as having behaved with extraordinary courage. It has raised many thousands of pounds to support families who are victims of terrorism and murder, and Suzanne's inspiring work has also led her to being awarded an MBE and the Pride of Britain Award. All proceeds from the event will go towards the newly established Joel Richards Scholarship Fund, which will support University of Worcester students in gaining national qualifications in such areas as coaching, refereeing, tutoring, first aid and other valuable areas. Suzanne said Joel dedicated his life to helping others through sport, knowing that this scholarship fund will carry on his spirit fills us with pride and gratitude. Owen and I are truly honoured that the University of Worcester continues to keep his memory alive. To book, email rsvp@work.ac.uk or visit worcester.ac.uk/events. We believe in second chances, pub chain helps prison inmates. This article is brought to you by Beverley Raidmaker, and their support to this article is a picture which has the launch of the Crown and Key at HMP Stoke Heath in Shropshire. Prison inmates will gain new skills and a chance to find a fulfilling career upon release thanks to the launch of a new hospitality academy called the Crown and Key at HMP Stoke Heath in Shropshire, launched by pub company Marston's. The initiative, which helps offenders train for careers in pub kitchens as part of their rehabilitation, builds on the success of the lock-in scheme at HMP Liverpool and is part of Marston's Excel programme, which supports prison leavers into meaningful jobs helping to cut reoffending. Developed with Norvis Education and New Futures Network, the Crown and Kent at HMP Stoke Health near Market Drayton in Shropshire has been developed to providing real-world culinary training in a fully refurbished restaurant and pub setting, giving inmates chances to hone their skills by cooking for prison staff and contractors. Up to 40 men each year will train towards line chef roles, gaining hands-on experience, recognised qualifications and a pathway to employment with Marston's upon release. Wolverhampton headquartered Marston's aims to increase the number of graduates employed across its pubs by 25% this year. Todd Lockley, Senior Inclusion and Communities Manager at Marston's, said, "At Marston's we believe in second chances. These academies provide practical skills, qualifications and real job opportunities, helping people rebuild their lives while strengthening our communities and our industry. offering employment to prison leavers reduces the chances of reoffending by up to 87%, and we are proud to play part in their rehabilitation. That's why we like to increase the number of ex-offenders we employ by a quarter this year. The programme received royal recognition when HRH the Prince Royal visited HMP Stoke Heath in July to tour the facility during his construction, and the launch of the Crowning Key was attended by Tim Manton, Mayor of Market Drayton. Marston's wider Excel programme has already supported 80 people in employment since 2022, achieving retention rates far above the industry average and opening opportunities for underrepresented groups. Cameron Fisher, an Excel graduate now employed at Marston's, added, "This is the best thing I could have done. Learning these new skills gained employment in a home has probably been one of the best feelings I've ever had. It really gave me the self-worth and confidence. I know that there are companies and people out there that will give you a second chance. I couldn't have done this without the support from Marston."
This is Alison, reading a selection of articles from the Express and Star dated Thursday, the 16th of October. Winter fuel payments scam warning put out to pensioners. Government: deposits are automatic and we never ask for bank details by text. Pensioners are being warned to watch out for winter fuel payment scams after a spike in referrals ahead of the money reaching people's bank accounts from next month. The Department for Work and Pensions, DWP, is urging people not to engage with scam messages. His Majesty's Revenue and Customs data revealed a 153% rise in scam referrals in the final week of September, compared with the previous week. Fraudsters will send messages purporting to be from government officials processing winter fuel payment applications. The scam communications had started to drop off after a peak in June, but are on the increase again, ahead of payments being made next month. But the government said that winter fuel payments are made automatically and it will never ask for bank details by text. Anyone who receives a text message inviting them to apply for a payment should not engage with it and instead forward it to 7726, the government said. The DWP said it is ramping up its social media campaign in partnership with Action Fraud to raise awareness of these scams, alongside working with charities. Work and Pension Secretary Pat McFadden said, "If you get a text message about winter fuel payments, it's a scam. They will be made automatically, so you do not need to apply. These despicable attempts by criminals to target people are on the rise. We are raising awareness to make it harder for fraudsters to succeed. If you receive a suspicious message about winter fuel payments, don't engage. Forward it to 7726 and delete it immediately. Winter fuel payments will automatically be paid into people's bank accounts, with eligible pensioners receiving a letter in October or November saying how much they will receive. Payments will be made between mid-November and December 2025. Inquiry into illegal ghost plates welcomed by PCC. West Midlands Police and Crime Commissioner Simon Foster and local MP Sarah Coombs have welcomed the launch of a new parliamentary vehicle registration plate inquiry. It has been described as a major milestone in their long-running campaign to crack down on illegal ghost plates in the West Midlands. The inquiry, led by the All-Party Parliamentary Group, APPG, for Transport Safety, will examine the growing problem of untraceable number plates, which allow dangerous drivers and criminals to evade detection, enforcement and accountability on the UK's roads. The move follows the success of Operation Phantom, an initiative led by PCC Simon Foster and West Midlands Police's Roads Policing Unit with Red Speed International, which used cutting-edge technology to expose thousands of illegal number plates operating across Birmingham. These initial findings provide an early understanding of the scale of the issue. Mr. Foster said, "This is a very significant and welcome step forward in the fight against illegal 3D and 4D number plates, known as ghost plates. This inquiry is about exposing offenders, bringing them to justice, and keeping people safe on our roads. It's vital that we now build on this progress and deliver the changes needed to tighten up the law and keep the people and communities of our region safe and secure." Sarah Coombs, MP for West Bromwich and a member of the APPG for Transport Safety, said, "I'm pleased that in the West Midlands, we are in the vanguard of action to crack down on illegal number plates. The results of Operation Phantom exposed just how big the problem of ghost plates is in our region, which is why there could be no better time for a parliamentary inquiry into this issue. I'm calling for tougher penalties for people who willfully evade detection by AMPR and who are making our roads unsafe. I hope this inquiry will find that there is no excuse for using a ghost plate and demand an end to this number plate Wild West. 6 reasons why it is vital to keep notices. Important alcohol licence applications published in the Express and Star. The government is looking to end the requirement that applications for new drinks and entertainment licences should be published in public notice sections of local newspapers. Very often, this feedback proves invaluable to both the applicant and the neighbours. As the cases below demonstrate, good communication often allows the parties to agree on a compromise that allows the business to expand the trade, with mitigation measures that keep the residents happy. But this can only happen if people know what is going on in their neighbourhood, something that is under threat from the government's latest proposals. Here are 6 reasons why the government should not remove the requirement for drink and public entertainments licence applications to be advertised in local newspapers. 1. Last month, residents raised concerns about plans for another late-night off-licence in Bearwood High Street after a notice was placed in the Express and Star. Plans to turn the former Twisty Pretzel Bakery attracted a string of objections from neighbours, concerned about the proliferation of such shops in the area. The advert was placed as part of a compulsory consultation exercise and gave the public the opportunity to have their say on the matter. 2. In January, Walsall Council agreed to allow Samira Rukmal Kahandaga Mage to sell alcoholic drinks from his shop in Stafford Street, Willenhall, but imposed strict conditions after a member of the public voiced concerns about antisocial behaviour in the area. Mr. Kahandaga Mage agreed not to stock beers or ciders stronger than 6.5%, except for craft beers, in order to minimise the risk of drunken behaviour. He agreed not to sell single cans or bottles of beers or ciders and said he would ensure that drinks accounted for no more than 25% of his stock on display. The conditions were agreed after a resident said Stafford Street already had a problem with drinking in public, with children as young as 13 years old having been seen to be consuming alcohol on the streets. Had the details of the application not been made public, residents would not have had a voice and their concerns would have gone unheeded. 3. In July, Dudley Council gave permission for the former Old Courthouse pub in King's Winford to be brought back into use as a bar and grill after granting it a drinks licence. However, conditions were imposed saying that music must not be played after 12:30 a.m. after 3 concerns were raised by neighbours. More than 100 people objected to Sporting Khalsa FC's application for a late-night drink and entertainment licence last year, voicing concerns about noise, pollution and traffic. The licence was granted after Talas Singh Dosanjh told councillors that the bar would only be open on match days and would make no difference to traffic levels as the customers would already travel there for the match. The committee did agree to impose a condition that all litter must be cleared up at the end of each night's trading. The important thing is that the decision was made in full consideration of residents' concerns, which would have gone unheard had they not been informed about them in the newspaper. 5. When Old Wulfrunian Sports and Social Club, near Wolverhampton, applied for a licence allowing outdoor drinking until 1 a.m, it led to objections from 14 residents. In response, the club amended its application so that the activities ended at 9 p.m. Monday to Thursday and 11 p.m. Friday, Saturday and Sunday, and the licence was granted. 6. This year, the Boathouse Pub in Rushall applied to extend its opening hours to 1:30 a.m. on Fridays, Saturdays and Sundays, with drinks served and music played until 1 a.m. The proposals attracted objections from neighbours. In response, Star Pubs and Bars withdrew the live and recorded music aspect of the application, offered to close windows and doors and close off the outside area, except for smokers, at 10:45 p.m. Councillor Lorna Rattigan welcomed the mitigation measures and the licence was granted. Teenage frontman, far from lost with his band. He's only 17, but Josh Millard Lloyd has packed plenty in already, from being a child actor, getting a break on the airwaves, and also the frontman of a band taking to the stage in Birmingham this weekend. Albury-based Josh fronts rock and pop outfit The Lost, who will be playing at the O2 Academy 3 on Saturday night, then headlining at the Rainbow, Digbeth, the following Wednesday. When he was 8 years old, Josh became a child actor, appearing in films including Ray and Liz and Nativity Rocks with Craig Revel Horwood, Celia Imrie and Ruth Jones. He also has a burgeoning broadcasting career with Black Country Radio and Black Country Extra, after going in for work experience and following it up with an interview about his band before becoming a fully-fledged presenter. His radio work has led him to become part of the Buskin for Charity group, along with fellow presenter and poet Billy Spakeman, who he says has become a mentor to him. The pair teamed up for a charity football match at Tiberdale FC last year. Josh is enrolled on a music performance course at Birmingham Ormiston Academy, where he met the other four members of the band. Ben Brindle, Jake Clift from Walsall, Joe Cooper from Hagley, and Bryce Gersbach, who is originally from South Africa but now lives in Bromsgrove. Josh told the Express and Star, "As young people who met at the same music college, we all bonded over our shared love for music and performing on stage. Our first gig was at the Rainbow, so to go back there next week will be special, as will the O2 gig on Saturday night. Black Country Radio have been great in terms of promoting the band and giving me work experience, which has led to me presenting programmes on Extra, which is speech-based. Billy has become a great friend, and I have learned a lot from him. He does so much for the community as well. In terms of the band, I would describe our sets as a mix of original songs and covers, but it's the originals that really define us, upbeat and full of raw energy. What we enjoy most is the chemistry and friendship we have on stage, which has come from being friends at college and a lot of rehearsals and writing sessions. We've grown together as musicians, and we hope that connection comes through every time we play live, which is what we love doing." Josh said he maintains an agent for any acting work that should be available and continues to volunteer at Black Country Radio, but at the moment is concentrating on his college studies and rehearsing and playing with The Lost. Tickets for Saturday's gig can be purchased from the Ticketmaster website. Unemployment figures are still highest in the country. Unemployment in the West Midlands remains the highest in the country at 6.2%, according to latest statistics. New figures, published by the Office for National Statistics, ONS, on Tuesday, covering the period from June to August 2025, showed the region has the highest unemployment figure out of all UK regions for the second consecutive month. In the West Midlands, 195,000 people were listed as unemployed, up 20,000 on the quarter and up 65,000 on the year, with latest stats putting the rate of unemployment in the region at 6.2%, up 0.5% on the quarter and up 1.9% year on year. Meanwhile, 396,000 people were living in non-working households. On the flip side, 2.95 million people in the region were employed, up 35,000 on the quarter and up 21,000 on the year, with the rate remaining at 73.2%, unchanged on the quarter and down 0.6% on the year. Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, Pat McFadden MP, said, "The numbers of people in work and looking for work are at a record high. However, there are still too many people locked out of employment or training and missing out on the security a good job provides." The MP, who represents Wolverhampton South West, said the government is reforming job centres and investing in its Connect to Work programme to build a workforce fit for the future and boost economic growth in every corner of the UK as part of the plan for change. Emily Stubbs, head of policy at Greater Birmingham Chambers of Commerce, said of the latest figures, "For a second consecutive month, the West Midlands has the highest unemployment rate in the country. And while the ONS caution against comparisons with volatile estimates throughout 2024, it appears unemployment in the region has risen sharply over the past year, at a rate well above the national average. Unfortunately, taken together with data from other regions across the UK, these figures are unlikely to encourage the Bank of England to cut interest rates further before the end of the year. She said the Chamber's latest quarterly business report shows labour costs, exacerbated by national insurance hikes earlier this year, remain the biggest cost pressure for firms in the Birmingham area. The Chamber will continue to work with businesses to understand why challenges are being felt so strongly in our region and to provide support to local firms, she said.
This is Lauren with some stories from the Express and Star from the 17th of October. Four people deny assisting murderer to evade the police. Four people are to stand trial for helping the murderer of an Oldbury schoolboy evade police. Josiah Coke, 13, was stabbed to death in Oldbury last August. His teenage killer fled the scene, and despite a massive manhunt, the teenager evaded police for 6 days until he handed himself in. After a trial, he was found guilty of murder and handed a life sentence. After reviewing how the murderer escaped arrest, police have charged four people with perverting the course of justice. Lindsay Marquis, 30, of Bittle Close, Birmingham, Robert Platt, 34, and Lauren Carty, 30, both of Hastings Drive, Worcestershire, and a Birmingham female in her 20s, deny the charge. I'm still living the dream after a decade in business. Written by Beverly Radmacher. An Oldbury hair and beauty salon boss is celebrating 10 years in business after taking a leap of faith at the age of 20 to pursue her dream. Origin Hair and Beauty Salon and Training Academy, founded by Sarah Louise Charlton, is marking its 10th anniversary this week. To celebrate the milestone, which was officially on October 13th, Sarah Louise has organised a get-together at the salon in Causeway Green Road for staff and clients with drinks and cake. Now aged 35, the young entrepreneur has told of her joy to have notched up a decade in the industry she loves and to also be training the next generation. She said, "It's always been my dream to have my own nail business. From a young age, I was forever painting nails, brushing hair and doing makeup. My family always knew this was where I was heading. As the years have passed, my business thrived and my next milestone was to reach 10 years. And today, at 35, I'm proud to say I've achieved that goal and I'm still living my dream." Sarah Louise, however, didn't stop there and has since developed a training academy as well as the salon, returning to college to complete a teaching diploma so she can train other aspiring beauticians to reach their goals in this amazing industry. Alongside this article is a picture of Sarah Louise. She stood in her salon, which has a brick wall with a wooden plank across it with in white writing that says Origin. There are two helium gold balloons in the numbers 10 and a big balloon arch full of green and gold and white and clear balloons of varying sizes. The entire salon has chairs and tables in the background where the nail business is, and it's decorated with pumpkins and leaves. She herself is stood in the centre of the room. She has brown hair, which is nicely blow-dried. She has a brown sleeveless sweater on and a watch and is holding a glass of orange juice or maybe a mimosa, and she's smiling at the camera. It's captioned Sarah Louise Charlton, an Origin Hair and Beauty Salon and Training Centre, marking 10 years in business. Music Charity unveils vibrant programme, written by David Banner. A thrilling lineup of comedy, live music, dance and spoken word is coming to Birmingham's iconic Symphony Hall and Town Hall as the music charity Be Music unveils its vibrant winter programme for 2025-26. This winter, Be Music welcomes an exceptional season of entertainment to its famous stages, Birmingham Town Hall and Symphony Hall.
The programme is a rich tapestry of world-class music, side-splitting comedy and unforgettable family shows, offering something for every taste as the nights draw in. The musical lineup spans classical, blues and contemporary genres. In a major coup for the city, the renowned conductor Sir Simon Rattle returns home for one of only three UK dates. He is joined by world-class Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra, an event certain to be a landmark in the classical calendar. For those with a passion for rhythm and blues, the legendary Jules Holland and his acclaimed Rhythm and Blues Orchestra will deliver two nights, featuring a roster of special guests, including singer Ruby Turner. Adding a contemporary edge, Grammy-winning artist Maren Morris will redefine country pop with her powerhouse vocals and genre-blending hits. Furthermore, BBC Radio 3 presents a special celebration of the 50th anniversary of Queen's iconic album, A Night at the Opera. Comedy lovers are also in for a treat, with a star lineup of stand-up talent taking over the town hall. Throughout November, audiences can enjoy international stars like Ursula Carlson in You Don't Say and the brilliant Jen Brister in Reactive. The festive season kicks into high gear with a spectacular all-star comedy show, Live at Christmas, which for one night only offers five top comedians for the price of one. Headlined by the wildly inventive Taskmaster champion Sam Campbell and hosted by the acclaimed Amy Gledhill. Families are invited to create lasting memories with a selection of unmissable events. From the mischievous and explosive experiments of the UK's original family science show, Brainiac Live, to a truly special screening of the classic animated film Wallace and Gromit: The Wrong Trousers, accompanied by the world-renowned Corey Band, there is magic in store for all ages. The season is also rich with unique and enlightening performances. The celebrated actor Anton Lesser, known for his roles in Wolf Hall and Game of Thrones, will give a solo performance of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, accompanied by the orchestra of the Swan, bringing the timeless story to life in the very spirit of Dickens' own readings. Meanwhile, Britain's best-loved wordsmith Susie Dent returns with a brand new show, Word Perfect, to celebrate the endless joys, curiosities and fascinating histories of the English language. This is just a glimpse of the winter wonders awaiting you. To explore the full programme and secure your tickets for these must-see events, visit the official website at bmusic.co.uk. That's the letter B, music. Alongside this article is a picture of Jules Holland. He is stood in front of a background that is blurred, and he has very, very short grey hair, a black shirt and a black blazer on, and he is smiling at the camera. It's captioned, "Jules Holland and his Rhythm and Blues Orchestra play for two nights." New fan board gets backed by owner Shillen. 10 Albion supporters have been selected to sit on a new fan advisory board, set up to give the fanbase a voice on all matters surrounding the club. Plans for the first fan advisory board were launched earlier this year, with the endorsement of owner Shillen Patel, who has kept the Albion fanbase informed on all matters involving the club since he took charge in early 2024. The board, which is part of a wider fan engagement plan, is designed to be a dialogue between supporters and the club's key decision makers. The lineup of the board was announced this week and includes a range of different Baggies fans from different groups. The FAB is made up of 10 members, with 3 seats taken by representatives from supporters groups, such as Claire Sidaway of All Access Albion, Sarah Curtin from Proud Baggies, and Shin Orgula of Apna Albion. 2 members from the Albion Assembly were added to the group, with others going through an application and interviewing process that included Julia Regis, wife of Albion legend Cyril. The scope will focus on the club's strategic vision, business operations, stadium, key match day issues, heritage issues, community activities, and Albion's equality, diversity, and inclusion commitments.
Hello, this is Sarbjit with your news from the Express and Star, Saturday the 18th of October. Murder accused drinker, tells jury he did not mean to seriously hurt man. One of the men accused of murdering Matthew Adams told a jury he did not want to harm him and was only punching him to end the confrontation. Mark Shorthouse, age 55, took the witness stand to give evidence in the first day of the case for the defence in the trial at Wolverhampton Crown Court. Shorthouse was shown CCTV of father of two, Mr. Adams, being battered outside the Gough Arms in the early hours of March 19, 2023. The 33-year-old died 4 days later. Shorthouse admitted he did not remember a lot of the night. He said, "I vaguely remember escorting him out of the pub." In the footage, Shorthouse of Sandwell could be seen throwing a punch and missing, aiming a kick and missing, until he got closer to Mr. Adams when he punched him to the ground before kicking him again on the floor. Mr. Adams was seen staggering to his feet several times, only for the group to hit him again. However, when Shorthouse floored Mr. Adams, he was left unconscious on the floor, the court heard. He said, "I do not remember doing that, but watching it, I feel ashamed. It was uncalled for." Asked by defence barrister Amjad Malik KC what he was doing during the violent disorder, he said, "In the heat of the moment, I was trying to end the confrontation, put an end to everything which was going on. I did not mean to cause any serious harm to Mr. Adams." Shorthouse told the jury he had admitted violent disorder, but denied he wanted to cause Mr. Adams any serious harm in the fight. His fellow defendants are Ryan Stanley, 30, John Wise, 42, and a 16-year-old boy, all of Sandwell, who all deny murder, manslaughter and violent disorder. Nicola Stanley, 39, also of Sandwell, denies violent disorder relating to the case. The trial continues. Halloween Harbingers Are Getting Into My Sleep Cycle by Dan Morris. Halloween is almost here, and this year it's got into my dreams. This has never happened before, and I can't quite put my finger on why this new phenomenon has come to affect me. But for the last few days, my sleep has been populated with weird visions of cliched axe-wielding clowns, wickedly wicked Blair Witch witches, and even the odd murderous ventriloquist dummy. These dreams haven't been nightmares. I haven't been waking up in cold sweats or in need of a cuddle. In fact, bizarrely, their content has unnerved me very little. I've just got no explanation as to why this year's spooky season has seen its mascots mess with my melon while I'm getting my beauty's eds. I don't tend to watch a lot of horror films, though I haven't got a problem with them, and they certainly don't keep me awake at night. Of course, with many streaming providers, they are the flavour of the current season, and so a lot of adverts pertaining to the grim and the grisly have been coming at me through the telly box. I am a sucker for falling asleep with the TV on, and find my dreams are often influenced by whatever's playing while I'm in the land of Nod. I've even been known to use this to intentionally attempt to influence my dreams, deliberately falling asleep to Star Wars in the hope of awakening inside some luscious lightsaber-filled adventure. Typically, this rarely pans out quite as planned. Last time I ended up as Jabba the Hutt's cat thingy. Anyway, back to the original point. It is entirely possible, if not even likely, that TV's influence has been the cause of the ghastly ghouls that have made their home in my slumbering cerebellum. But, if so, why has this never happened before? Horror's October telly takeover is hardly a new thing for this Halloween, so why have the likes of Freddy Krueger, Jason Voorhees and Lewis Spence never made their way into my nodding bonts on any of the other 37 All Hallows Eve I've lived through? Could it be that, if anything, I'm actually getting more impressionable in my old age? Debate over the influence of TV and digital media on young and growing minds is something that has raged now for decades. I've never been a big believer in the idea that a youngster will grow up to be a criminal simply because they've played on Grand Theft Auto, or that, in general, television rots the brain. Still, there is no escaping the fact that gaming, telly and everything else under the digital entertainment umbrella can have a powerful effect on your noggin. All the above are designed to stimulate you, hold your attention and leave an impression so that you watch or play again. Though most adults are, hopefully, beyond the stage of having their sense of right and wrong warped by the box, TV can leave its mark on us, just as it does with children. I remember all too well how The Only Way Is Essex came to severely affect the vocabulary of some of my former colleagues. Overnight they were, well, gel. Of course, as well as having my dreams invaded by the cast of I Know What You Did Last Summer, I too have frequently, unintentionally, infected by TV's power over my time. Reruns of The Sopranos have seen me indulge almost exclusively in a lasagna-based diet until I get bored, switch to House of Cards, and it becomes all about the ribs, ribs, ribs. I constantly find myself singing the People's Postcode Lottery song, when the Pepto-Bismol ad isn't calling the shots, that is. And, worst or best of all, depending on your persuasion, I've already left instructions in my will to be cremated to the Bluey theme. Her dad, Bandit, just gets me and is without question my new spirit animal. So, on reflection, it is of no great surprise that TV and films, Halloween Herald, have finally broken into my subconscious. I certainly don't fight any of telly's dirty food harbingers as they wheedle their way into my psyche, so my brain barriers were probably very easy for the Bride of Chucky and co. to leap over. Perhaps the only thing to do is weather the storm for the next 2 weeks, let Michael Myers and the gang get nice and comfy, and maybe work on giving them a bit of alternative company by indulging in a bit of late-night animated fun. Who hasn't wanted to dream of being in a poker game with Leatherface, Pennywise and Peter Griffin? Deal me in, boys. Man and woman held as police investigate two rape incidents. A man and a woman, aged 49 and 65, have been arrested as part of an investigation into a rape in Hales Owen and the racially aggravated rape of a Sikh woman in Oldbury. West Midlands police were called to Hurst Green Park, Hales Owen, at around 7 p.m. on Thursday after a woman in her 30s reported that she had been attacked in the area. The man and woman were arrested yesterday morning on suspicion of rape. Following further investigation, officers also subsequently arrested the pair in connection with the racially aggravated rape of a Sikh woman in a parkland on Tame Road, Oldbury, on September 9. The September 9 attack saw widespread public anxiety among local women and families in the area. Following the incident, a large manhunt was launched, with two rewards of a combined £30,000 being offered for information leading to a successful conviction. The force said that a cordon in Hurst Green Park still remained in place in the park while investigations continue. Ticketless, tap in, tap out, trams will see end to conductors in New Year. There is a picture of the Midland Metro at the Wolverhampton St George's stop. West Midlands Metro buses are rolling out a new ticketing system. Infrastructure is being installed to make the Midland Metro ticketless and to remove conductors from its trams. West Midlands Metro buses are planning to roll out a new ticketing system across the network, which currently runs between Wolverhampton and Birmingham. It says it wants to make paying for tickets to travel on the tram faster, easier and more convenient for passengers. But the system will see the end of conductors, a move that has dismayed many passengers who enjoy the human interaction on board services. Validator poles are now being installed at tram stops across the network, which will soon support a new system enabling customers to simply tap in and tap out to pay for their journey using a contactless bank card, travel pass or smart device. The new technology is due to be switched on in the new year, with bosses saying the major upgrade is set to bring wide-ranging benefits for customers while promoting fairness across the network. West Midlands Metro says customers can still buy tickets from the conductors aboard the trams until the new technology is fully rolled out, with relevant staff eventually being redeployed in other roles. Michael Redding Skilton, head of commercial at West Midlands Metro, explained, "Over the next couple of months, customers will see the poles that will hold the validators being installed at tram stops, marking another significant step towards a fairer, more inclusive network. As well as making it quicker and more convenient to buy a ticket, the new system will automatically calculate the best fare to cover the cost of the customer's journey. For those making multiple trips or travelling over several days, the system will cap the total cost to guarantee great value for customers. Plans are also in place to make the new validator system compatible with other modes of transport in the region, enabling seamless travel between bus and tram in the West Midlands." Mr. Redding Skilton added, "While the validators are being installed, we would urge all customers to follow any signage alerting them to work being undertaken on the platform." Women's voices should be heard. Khan and Healy launch a podcast which puts the spotlight on female health issues. There are several pictures. There is a picture of Cherry Healy and Dr. Amir Khan. There is a picture of Healy, who's launching a competition asking children to draw the train journey of their dreams. And a picture of Dr. Khan, the first ever ambassador for Leeds Hospital Trust, during a tour of the vaccine centre. Women's health is an everyone issue, according to television presenter and health advocate Cherry Healy. "A lot of people don't feel listened to when they go to the doctor," the 44-year-old says. "They often end up Googling or checking on TikTok to try and find information and self-diagnosing. But the internet is wild and you can really scare yourself." A 2022 YouGov survey found that 80% of women say they don't feel heard by their doctors. To address this, Healy has launched a podcast, No Appointment Necessary, alongside full-time GP and author Dr. Amir Khan, a resident doctor for ITV's Lorraine and Good Morning Britain. It aims to offer trusted, no-nonsense health advice to help women feel heard and understood. One of the main purposes of this podcast is to get everything you need to know about subjects like UTIs, alcohol, libido, weight loss jabs, and everything else in half an hour, so you can equip yourself to go to the GP if you manage to get an appointment. "We want the podcast to be really entertaining and fun," Healy adds. "But the root of it is that it has to be an incredibly useful health resource for women and men, because women's health is not just a women's issue. We're often the glue that holds the society and community together. So when we're not okay, everyone is not okay because of the ripple effect." Khan adds that the podcast is important because not only do he and Healy show their vulnerable sides as a doctor and a television presenter, but they're also normal people. "I am a working GP in Bradford, and we talk about things that affect everyone all the time, including ourselves," he says. There's a Chat GP segment where Khan answers listeners' questions and Healy pushes Khan to tackle the toughest questions, including medical misogyny, which he says is very real. "I'm saying this as a man, but there is this idea for women that it's okay for them to suffer, or it's okay for them to have heavy periods or terrible menopause because it's natural," says the 44-year-old. He stresses that this should never be the case for women. "The tide is turning a little with these conversations, but these are the kind of topics that we discuss on the podcast, he adds. He says that he's often had women in his consultation room in tears because they're angry and frustrated with the system. Healy suffers from UTIs. I had my first UTI when I was 3 years old, she says. I know what it feels like to have one. However, the song, dance and the hilarity of trying to get antibiotics is wild. If you know, you know. But when you've got a UTI, it's a very strong feeling. And because I've had them for some time, I really know my way around it, she says. Once, I couldn't get antibiotics because I wasn't believed, Healy explains, as she recalls a time when she was maid of honour at a wedding. I told the doctor I had UTIs all my life and could they please send antibiotics to a local pharmacy. But they refused and said they just didn't believe I had one until they seen the urine sample. Without access to antibiotics, Healy had no chance but to go through with the wedding. The next evening, my husband looked at me and said, "You look unbelievably unwell, and you've gone grey." And I felt like I was dying. We went to A&E, and I was in hospital for 5 days on a drip. That's after 24 hours of not being able to get antibiotics, she says. There are currently 5 erectile dysfunction cures available for men, but not one single over-the-counter UTI cure, she adds. There's no cure for endometriosis, which is debilitating. There's a lack of research and a lack of resources for women. Although there is a strong emphasis on physical health, both Khan and Healy say they now prioritise their mental well-being, having been shaped by their own life experiences. I found perimenopause hit me mentally before it hit me physically, Healy says. I would say that I suffer from a normal amount of anxiety for a people pleaser who's worried about what people think of me. When I hit 40, I was feeling anxious for 3 hours. Then I would have that anxiety for half of the day, and then I'd be anxious for a whole day. I remember sitting in a car park and calling my friend Kate and crying on the phone saying, "There's something wrong." I wasn't myself, so I had a really interesting chat with a gynecologist who said, "You're not going crazy. Don't worry. This is the perimenopause and there are things that you can do in your life before you try HRT to try and diminish it." It helped absolutely massively. The thing that helped me most through was knowledge, because now I wake up at 4 a.m, I know it's my hormones fluctuating and that I'm okay. I take some deep breaths, I ride it out and I go straight back to sleep because I no longer think I'm having a heart attack. Khan admits that he used to think he had quite robust mental health and didn't really suffer from anxiety. That was until I started on TV and on social media, he says. I obviously wasn't prepared already for other people's opinions on every aspect of what I said or did or looked like. When it all suddenly started without any preparation, it did cause huge anxiety for me, and I found it a really challenging thing to adjust to. No Appointment Necessary is available now on all major podcast platforms and YouTube, with new episodes every Tuesday.
Hello, this is Jenny. I hope this finds you well. Autumn's in full swing and school's getting ready to break up next week for a much needed rest. Anyway, here's my recordings for this week from the Express and Star newspaper, Monday the 20th of October. Greggs is to revamp Baggies ground site. The refurbishment of a Grade 2 listed Greggs next to West Bromwich Albion's home ground, the Hawthorns, has been approved by council planners. The building, on the corner of Birmingham Road and Halfords Lane, which was home to the Baggies Supporters Club before it closed in 2004, will be refitted with new counters and a renovated kitchen. The designs show a Baggies-themed interior, including blue and white seats, and photos of past Albion players, as well as nods to the Black Country Club and the building's history. The application by Greggs said the building's exterior would also be cleaned. From five-star to unhygienic, food outlets in the spotlight. Food Standards Agency inspectors give guidance to potential customers. An article by Dan Stacey. Restaurants, takeaways, public houses and food outlets across the West Midlands have received new food hygiene ratings. The Food Standards Agency ratings have been given out across Wolverhampton, Sandwell, Dudley and South Staffordshire. The ratings give potential customers an idea of the hygiene standards, with a rating of 5 being the best possible result. A score of 5 is considered very good, 4 good, 3 generally satisfactory, 2 some improvement necessary, 1 major improvement necessary, and 0 urgent improvement necessary. These are the latest ratings. For Sandwell, restaurants, cafes and canteens. 4-star, the Abbey Bar and Grill at Abbey Public House, Abbey Road, Smethwick. 3 stars, Golu Dadabia at Golu Dadabia, 160 Rolfe Street, Smethwick. Takeaways. 4-star, Bites Desserts at 292 Hagley Road West, Oldbury. Pizza Land at 162 Causeway Green Road, Oldbury. 3 stars, Layla Z Food Limited at 96 Tividale Road, Tipton. And 1 star, Caribbean Corner Takeaway at number 1 Thimble Mill Road, Smethwick. Have you got a cold or fallen ill with COVID? Here's some expert advice if you are feeling under the weather. An article by Camilla Foster, health correspondent. Coughs and sneezes seem to be inescapable at the moment. Whether you're at work, commuting or relaxing at home, it's hard to avoid them. With headlines buzzing about new COVID variants and social media filled with speculation, it's becoming increasingly difficult to tell whether that scratchy throat or runny nose is a sign of COVID or just a typical seasonal cold. To help clear up the confusion, we spoke to the experts. What causes a cold and COVID? Colds are caused by a bunch of different viruses, but the most common culprit is the rhinovirus, a tiny troublemaker that loves to set up camp in your nose and throat, explains Dr. Chun Tang, GP at Pall Mall Medical. COVID, on the other hand, is caused by a single virus, SARS-CoV-2, which is a type of coronavirus. Both attack your respiratory system, but COVID tends to go deeper, sometimes affecting the lungs and even other organs. What is the new strain of COVID? Stratus XFG and Nimbus MB.1.8.1 are some of the newest strains of COVID that have been dominating headlines recently. Stratus is linked to hoarseness and fatigue, whereas Nimbus is associated with a razor blade sore throat and digestive symptoms like nausea and bloating, explained Dr. Bruno Sylvester Lopez, lecturer in microbiology at Teesside University. Both are highly transmittable, but not more severe than previous variants. How do COVID and cold spread? Both spread mainly through droplets when someone coughs, sneezes or even talks near you, says Tang. COVID, however, can also spread more easily through the air in tiny particles that linger, especially in crowded or poorly ventilated spaces. So while a cold might need a bit of close contact to catch, COVID can sometimes sneak across a room if you're unlucky. Are the symptoms different? Colds and COVID can be tricky to distinguish, as many of their symptoms overlap. Both can give you a sore throat, runny or stuffy nose, sneezing and coughing, says Tang. However, COVID can also cause fever, fatigue, muscle aches, and that telltale loss of taste or smell, although that's less common with the newer variants. COVID is also more likely to make you feel wiped out, like you've been hit by a truck, whereas a cold tends to stay in your head and chest. Cold symptoms normally last approximately for a week to 10 days, says Lopez, whereas COVID symptoms typically last for up to 2 weeks, but some may experience them for even longer, even persisting for months. COVID can also cause serious complications, such as pneumonia or long COVID, which affect multiple systems, not just the respiratory tract. Are the treatments different? Colds can be managed with rest, fluids and over-the-counter medications, such as paracetamol and decongestants, says Lopez. Mild cases of COVID are treated similarly, but high-risk individuals may be prescribed antivirals. Should I still test for COVID? Yes, especially if you're feeling unwell and work around vulnerable people, like in healthcare or care homes, or if you want to avoid spreading it to your family members who might be at risk, says Tang. You can still buy rapid lateral flow tests from pharmacies or order them online. Testing helps you make informed choices, like staying home if you're positive. When should you go to a GP? You should see a GP if you have a high fever that won't go away, difficulty breathing, chest pains, or if your symptoms drag on beyond 10 to 14 days without improvement, advises Tang. For COVID specifically, seek help quickly if you feel short of breath or your oxygen levels drop. Always trust your gut if you're worried. Get checked out. Meanwhile, keep protected by washing hands and taking sensible steps. Staying up to date with vaccines give great protection, and don't underestimate the power of good sleep, a balanced diet and regular exercise. Man found dead in wooded area. A man has been found dead in a wooded area in Sandwell. Police say the death is not being treated as suspicious and are preparing a file for the coroner. It comes after a member of the public found a man unresponsive in Worley Woods, Smethwick, around 12:30 p.m. on Sunday, October the 19th. A statement from West Midlands Police said, a man was found unresponsive in Worley Woods at around 12:30 p.m. today by a member of the public. Sadly, he was confirmed dead at the scene. His death is not being treated as suspicious and a file will be prepared for the coroner in due course. If you witness any crime, you are able to report it anonymously to Crime Stoppers via 0800 555 111. Alternatively, you can use the organisation's website at https://crimestoppers-uk.org/. Millions stung by scams with online shopping. More than 7 million UK adults have been hit by a scam in the past year, with 20% of them significantly affected by the financial loss, Citizens Advice has found. Another 7 million adults knew of at least one other person who had been deceived by a scam, a survey for the charity suggests. More than a quarter of those personally scammed were targeted while online shopping, 26%, most commonly with fake websites and counterfeit or non-existent goods. The findings prompted Citizens Advice to urge customers to be cautious when taking advantage of shopping deals ahead of Black Friday and Christmas. Of the 20% of those caught out by a scam who were significantly impacted by the financial loss they suffered, 12% said they fell into debt or had to borrow money, and 10% said they had to use emergency savings. Some 20% were unable to carry out their work or caring responsibilities as a result of being scammed. Almost a quarter, 22%, transferred money after being pressured or convinced to, and 42% were contacted through social media. Citizens Advice said those it had supported with online shopping scams in the past year included consumers who had forked out hundreds of pounds for items such as clothes and mobile phones. Plan to convert a derelict pub into shops, flats and a HMO. An article by Christian Barnett, local Democracy reporter. An empty and boarded up former pub could be converted into shops, flats and a HMO if plans are approved. The former Nag's Head in Great Bridge Tipton closed in 2009 and could now be transformed into new shops, flats and a house of multiple occupation, HMO, according to a planning application by Davinda Burgee submitted to Samwell Council. The plans include converting the pub's former ground floor into two new retail units, with the rest of the building turned into two flats and a five-bed HMO. Samwell Council's planning committee meets on October the 22nd to decide on the plans which were submitted in March. In a report, the local authority's planning officers have recommended the application is approved. Four objections were made against the move. A report recommending approval said the proposed development would be acceptable in this location because it would bring a vacant building into a beneficial use, which would cause no significant harm to residential amenity, highway safety, or the character and appearance of a locally listed building, and is acceptable from the policy perspective. The provision of additional retail uses in this town centre location is also welcomed. The derelict pub, which closed 16 years ago, has been subject of several moves to bring the building back to life, as well as other plans to demolish the former watering hole completely. The first move to flatten the pub for 9 new flats was put forward a decade ago, but that was later withdrawn following objections, and then an application to convert the building into 2 new shops and 6 flats was backed in 2014. The pub, which dates back to the 1870s, remains an eyesore. In the mid-1990s, the Nag's Head was renamed the Fusilier in honour of Tipton-born Corporal Joseph Davis, who was awarded the Victoria Cross for leading 8 men to safety after they were left surrounded during a Battle of the Somme in the First World War. A blue plaque honouring Corporal Davis, who lived in nearby Knox Street, was placed on the Nag's Head in the early 90s. It followed a campaign by Tipton Civic Society and the town's Royal British Legion branch, which the pub also served as a headquarters for. The plaque was removed following the closure of the Nag's Head and now sits on the King's Arms in Tolland Road. The pub reverted back to the Nag's Head name in 2003, but closed in 2009.
When you asked to receive recordings produced by the Sandwell Talking News, you gave your name and address so that we could send you our memory sticks or CDs. This information is stored in a secure database, and address labels are also stored in a secure location. Having left our premises, the address labels and postal wallets are then under the protection and care of Royal Mail. Your contact details are only used for sending you our memory sticks or CDs, and will never be forwarded to a third party. If you ask us to stop sending Sandwell Talking News to you, your contact details will be deleted from our database and your address labels will be permanently destroyed. We promise and assure you that we take data protection seriously and make every effort to meet the requirements of the Data Protection Act. If your circumstances do change, you move home, change your phone number, or wish to unsubscribe to the Sandwell Talking News, please call the office on 0121 525 4810 or email sandwelltn@gmail.com so that we can make the necessary changes.
Some audio described TV programmes for the next week along with radio programme highlights from Talking News Federation. Search for publications TNF Soundings to hear these directly on their website.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, this is Val from Wharfdale Talking News with my selection of audio described TV programmes starting Saturday 25th to Friday 31st of October 2025. There are quite a few new series starting this week, so hopefully you will find something that interests you. Starting with Saturday, 25th of October. There are 3 episodes of The Simpsons on Channel 4 starting at 11:05 this morning. On BBC One at 11:30 a.m. we learn about the women who worked in Cornwall's mines in Rick Stein's Cornwall. For rugby league fans, there is live coverage on BBC One of the opening fixture in the 3-match Ashes series between England and Australia. Kick-off 2:30 p.m. For football fans over on ITV One, there is coverage of the women's friendly match between England and Brazil. Kick-off 5:30 p.m. Although not audio described, the commentary should give you a taste of the action. A murder at the vicarage is investigated in Agatha Christie's Marple on ITV3 at 3 p.m. The judges welcome back the remaining pairs in tonight's Strictly Come Dancing at 6:20 p.m. The early evening film on BBC Two at 6:20 p.m. is the fantasy Edward Scissorhands. Bettany uncovers some of Bulgaria's cultural and historical treasures in tonight's episode of Bettany Hughes' Treasures of the World at 7 p.m. on Channel 4. Hugh Bonneville narrates an aerial guide to the North Yorkshire Moors Railway from the coast at Whitby across the moors to the market town of Pickering. Great British Train Journeys from Above is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. The crime thriller The Equalizer, starring Denzel Washington, is this evening's film on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. Air authorities search desperately for the plane in nine bodies in a Mexican morgue on BBC One at 9:20 p.m. On to Sunday, 26th of October. Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, featuring interviews with politicians and key public figures, is on BBC One at 9 a.m. Roald Dahl's The Witches is this afternoon's fantasy film on BBC One at 3:15 p.m. Wildlife cameraman Hamza Yassin visits the South Devon coast in a bid to spot Atlantic bluefin tuna as they leap in the waves in the hunt for small bait fish. Hamza's Hidden Wild Isles is on BBC One at 6:15 p.m. Strictly Come Dancing The Results is on BBC One at 7:15 p.m. Guy Martin celebrates the 200th anniversary of the earliest passenger train's first journey along the Stockton and Darlington Railway in the documentary Guy Martin, The British Train That Changed the World on Channel 4 at 7:30 p.m. Kitty teeters on the verge of a nervous breakdown in the drama Riot Women at 9 p.m. on BBC One. Now the nights are drawing in, could there be anything nicer than joining Bob Mortimer and Paul Whitehouse to go fishing on a sunny day in May? It's Paul's birthday week, so they're hoping to catch wild brown trout in the River Itchen in Hampshire. This new series of Mortimer and Whitehouse Gone Fishing starts tonight on BBC Two at 9 p.m. Explosives officer Lana Washington and her team are called to investigate a suspected bomb in an abandoned taxi. The new series of the drama Trigger Point is on ITV One at 9 p.m. Continues tomorrow at the same time. At 9:30 p.m. on BBC Two, we have a new documentary series, Daisy May and Charlie Cooper's Night Watch. The siblings' first mission is to spend the night at the abandoned HMP Gloucester. Here are those programmes which are on at the same time throughout the week. On BBC One, Bargain Hunt is at 12:15 each day, but only audio described Tuesday to Thursday. Lost and Found in the Lakes is at 2:30 each day, and The Repair Shop on the Road is at 3:45 each day. On ITV One, Dickinson's Real Deal is at 2 p.m. each day. On Channel 4, there are two episodes of the US sitcom Frasier starting at 8:40 a.m. on Monday, and four episodes starting at 9:10 each morning, Tuesday to Friday. Heartbeat is on ITV 3 at around 5:45 and 6:50, Monday to Friday. Now for Monday, 27th of October. A new series exploring the growth of UK discount stores, Secrets of Super Cheap Shopping, is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. Once again, it's time to get our brains working with Mastermind at 7:30 and University Challenge at 8:30, both on BBC Two. Several choices at 9 tonight. Morgan takes drastic measures after Grace and Sean bring in Accountant George for questioning in tonight's episode of the police drama Blue Lights on BBC One at 9 p.m. A new four-part documentary series starts tonight, beginning an in-depth look at the amazing human story of space exploration. Once Upon a Time in Space is on BBC Two at 9. Lana and the team grow suspicious that they're not being told the truth as the investigation deepens. Episode 2 of Trigger Point is on ITV1 at 9. The polished facade of the Forsyte family's life is about to crumble in tonight's episode of the drama The Forsytes on Channel 5 at 9. Reverend Richard Coles heads north to the Faroe Islands in the second episode of Sailing the Shipping Forecast with the Reverend Richard Coles on Moor 4 at 9 p.m. Tuesday, 28th of October. To mark her 90th birthday earlier this year, Mary Berry looks back at her long career in food and meets some old friends in a new 6-part series, Mary at 90, A Lifetime of Cooking, on BBC Two at 7:30 p.m. Stacey and a team of experts help another family declutter their home. Sort Your Life Out with Stacey Solomon is on BBC One at 8 p.m. Alice Roberts joins a team of archaeologists hunting for relics from Oliver Cromwell's time. Digging for Britain is on BBC Two at 8 p.m. The four remaining bakers take on 3 patisserie challenges for the semi-final of the Great British Bake Off at 8 on Channel 4. Neil disagrees with Daniel about the murder victims being connected by their interests in the war and investigates Ned's wife. The drama Murder Before Evensong is on Channel 5 at 9 p.m. In My Own Words, Tom Jones on BBC One at 10:40 sees the veteran singer looking back on his life and career. Wednesday, 29th of October. An old butcher's bike, a pair of motorcycle racing goggles, a mysterious painting found in an attic, and a miniature toy boat are brought into the repair shop on BBC One at 8 p.m. In the documentary Tropic of Cancer with Simon Reeve on BBC Two at 8 p.m, the adventurer continues his journey in India. Breakfast proves to be a wake-up call for the faithful as the traitors strike again. The Celebrity Traitors is on BBC One at 9 p.m. Kevin MacLeod meets a couple who bought a folly next to their home in the West Midlands with plans to knock it down and replace it with a sprawling 21st century castle. Find out how they got on in Grand Designs on Channel 4 at 9. In North Wales, the Maritime Rescue Coordination Centre receive a call from a worried son about his 83-year-old father who has gone missing during a walk on a coastal path. Coast Guard SOS Search and Rescue is on Channel 5 at 9. Thursday, 30th of October. Another batch of entrepreneurs seek investment when they enter the Dragon's Den on BBC One at 8 p.m. In Shetland, it's the busiest night of the year as police deal with Viking revellers and a drunk driver. Highland Cops is on BBC One at 8. The architect ventures deep into New Zealand's Marlborough Sounds on the edge of one of the wildest and most unforgiving stretches of water in the world. George Clark's Homes in the Wild is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. A new 6-part drama series, Art Detectives, starts tonight at 8 p.m. on the U and Drama Channel. The opening case is set in a stately home with a dodgy Vermeer and a dead body in the study. As the game nears the end, the murders become increasingly harder to carry out for the traitors. The Celebrity Traitors is on BBC One at 9 p.m. In the drama The Ridge on BBC Two at 9, Maya makes enemies as she begins to line up suspects. Tristan and Charlotte enjoy a romantic picnic in tonight's episode of All Creatures Great and Small on Channel 5 at 9. And so we come to Friday, 31st of October. When someone sets fire to the local doctor's car, it's up to Eve and her team to find out who did it and why, in this first episode of a new series of Hope Street on BBC One at 2 p.m. Now for a documentary investigating life in Colombia as guerrilla groups battle for control of coca fields and lucrative smuggling routes. Guillermo Galdós travels to the Catatumbo region to meet the women fighting to protect their children. Unreported World, Guns and Cocaine, Colombia's Narco Wars, is on Channel 4 at 7:30pm. Yet another new drama series, when a scientist is found dead on a boat, D.I. Mackenzie Clark suspects they were murdered. Return to Paradise is on BBC One at 8pm. An investigation into the murder of a hurling star uncovers a gambling and prostitution ring and sporting rivalries as an entire community falls under suspicion. The first episode of the final two-part story in the Irish detective drama Borderline is on ITV One at 9pm. As it's Halloween, we end the night with the supernatural thriller Don't Look Now on BBC Two at 11:40pm. John and Laura Baxter go to Venice where they meet two sisters, one of whom claims she can communicate with their dead daughter, drawing the Baxters towards a mysterious fate. Enjoy your TV week.
This is Jilly with the radio listings for the 7 days beginning Saturday, 25th of October. And starting with Saturday, the 25th of October, the Real Comedy Controllers brings us favourite archive moments from the satire and sitcoms of the 1960s and 70s. It's on Radio 4 Extra at 3pm and 9pm. A recent performance from the Royal Opera House of Puccini's opera Tosca is on Radio 3 at 6pm. On Radio 4, the house at number 48 tells the story of a man's quest to uncover his family's dark past and reclaim a fortune stolen under the Nazis. The first 5 episodes can be heard on Radio 4 at 9pm today, before the series continues next week. Moving on to Sunday, 26th of October. The castaway in Desert Island Discs is actor and writer Lenny James on Radio 4 at 10am. While in an archive edition from 2018, comedian and TV star Alan Carr is the castaway on Radio 4 Extra at 6am, 11am and 5pm. In Sissinghurst, An Unfinished History, Adam Nicholson reads his account of growing up at Sissinghurst in Kent, bought in 1932 by his grandparents Vita Sackville West and Harold Nicholson. That's Radio 4 Extra at 7:30am, 12:30pm and 6:30pm. In Garden of England, Aidan Tullock spends the summer on a fruit farm in Kent, where he explores the human stories behind a punnet of blueberries on Radio 4 at 1:30pm. The Castle of Otranto is an adaptation of Horace Walpole's Gothic horror set in medieval Italy, Radio 4 at 3pm. To mark the 200th anniversary of the birth of Johann Strauss II, The Waltz Paradox visits Vienna to explore his life, character and influence on Radio 3 at 7:15pm. Turning now to those programmes which are broadcast at the same time every day from Monday to Friday. Murder in Mesopotamia is an Agatha Christie mystery starring John Moffat as Hercule Poirot on Radio 4 Extra at 6am, 11am and 5pm every day this week. The book of the week is Every Last Fish, an exploration of the world of fish and the industry that brings the creatures of the sea to dinner plates across the country. Radio 4 at 11:45am Monday to Friday. The house at number 48 continues on Radio 4 at 1:45pm every day this week. The composer of the week is Luciano Berio, 1925 to 2003, on Radio 3 at 4pm each day. Edith Piaf, in 5 songs, explores the life and work of the Paris-born singer through 5 songs associated with her, on Radio 3 at 9:45pm Monday to Friday. The book at bedtime continues the reading of Northwoods by Daniel Mason on Radio 4 at 10:45pm each day. Here are some individual programmes to listen to through the week, starting with Monday the 27th of October. In an episode of That Reminds Me from 2000, the late Victor Spinetti recalls his life and career on Radio 4 Extra at 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. The short series The Tax Conundrum continues, finding out what the UK can learn from the tax systems of Sweden and Estonia on Radio 4 at 11 a.m. There's an edition of the popular panel show Just a Minute on Radio 4 Extra at 2 p.m. and 8 p.m. And Disordered is a new comedy series about a single father coping with the rigours of daily life on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. Now, Tuesday the 28th of October. King of Bath is a historical comedy about Beau Nash, 1674 to 1761, on Radio 4 Extra at 7 a.m, 12 noon and 6 p.m. The Lost Stradivarius is a dramatisation of John Mead Faulkner's 1895 ghost novel, on Radio 4 Extra at 2:30 p.m. and 8:30 p.m. In History's Toughest Heroes, Ray Winston tells the story of Constance Bulwer Lytton, an aristocrat who was arrested for her involvement in the women's suffrage movement, on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. Queen Victoria's Nightmares discovers new information about the mental health struggles of Queen Victoria through the personal diaries of her doctor, on Radio 4 at 4 p.m. File on 4 Investigates examines the scale of problem gambling in the armed forces and the devastating impact on those serving veterans and their families, on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. Peter White brings us his regular programme In Touch, with news and information for people who are blind or partially sighted, on Radio 4 at 8:40 p.m. Now, Wednesday 29th of October. In today's drama, Back Home, Noreen, the head of a wildlife charity, returns home to her native Zambia after 20 years in the UK to give a speech about animal conservation, only for her family to bring up some difficult issues, Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. Titus Groan is a dramatisation of the first part of Mervyn Peake's gothic fantasy series Gormenghast, on Radio 4 Extra at 2:30 p.m. and 8:30 p.m. Choral Evensong comes from the Chapel of Lancing College, on Radio 3 at 3 p.m. In the Life Scientific, the Natural History Museum's Caroline Smith talks about what meteorites and other space rocks reveal about the early solar system and the potential for ancient life on Mars, on Radio 4 at 9 p.m. Then on Thursday the 30th of October, Why Birds Migrate and How They Navigate is the topic in the fourth of a selection of archive episodes of In Our Time, chosen by Melvin Bragg, on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. The subject of today's great lives is George Bernard Shaw, 1856 to 1950, on Radio 4 Extra at 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. Today's drama is Samhain by Ben Lewis. Claire and her husband are staying in an isolated old house on the remote Scottish island of Jura at the end of October. Of all the nights of the year, this is the one when the veil between this world and the next is said to be at its thinnest. Claire's past is about to reach out into her present. Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. In Ramblings, Claire Balding joins Nick Wilson for a circuit around Pittsford Reservoir in Northamptonshire. A former soldier, Nick now uses a power chair after a spinal injury and years of chronic pain made walking impossible. Radio 4 at 3 p.m. And in Radical with Amol Rajan, the journalist and broadcaster offers his take on the week's news on Radio 4 at 11 p.m. And finally to Friday the 31st of October, a six-part dramatisation from 1968 of The Day of the Triffids by John Wyndham begins on Radio 4 Extra at 6:30 a.m, 11:30 a.m. and 5:30 p.m. In the Loop is a new series in which poet Paul Farley investigates how circular formations are embedded in cultures throughout history, starting at the 5,000-year-old stone circle at Castlerigg in Cumbria on Radio 4 at 2:45 p.m. The Price of North Sea Oil is the story of Angie Weatherhead, who was five when her father was killed working in North Sea oil production in 1975. Years later, a chance to mark his death with dignity has a profound effect on her life. Radio 4 at 4:30 p.m. Friday night is Music Night, has a themed concert of film and TV music, including works by John Williams, Prokofiev and Grieg, on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. Enjoy your listening week.
TNS Soundings.
Hi, this is Kate, and I'm reading you some articles from the Express and Star, dated the 21st of the 10th, 2025. The debrief, Focus, Johnson loved, and Griffiths growing. We reflect on the Albion's latest talking points from Saturday's 2-1 victory over Preston. When Michael Smith halved the deficit with 12 minutes left, you would have been forgiven for thinking, here we go again. Home games against Derby twice and Leicester this season are still raw, and Ryan Mason certainly felt a sense of anxiety and possibly opening of battle scars late on against Preston. With 9 minutes was somehow displayed as the fourth officials board, the worst was probably feared. But on this occasion, it need not have been. Goalkeeper Josh Griffiths was only stretched by Daniel Jebberson's late strike from distance. Albion otherwise showed resilience and defended manfully to ensure no late onslaught. It felt like progress. Contest will remain tight this season given the nature of the division, and more late focus is required. Mikey Johnston was the game's most dangerous attacker, but Albion midfielder Alex Mowat delivered the most rounded overall display. Mowat's absence was felt at Millwall last time out, and he returned in some style here, delivering a captain's performance with the armband. His work without the ball was industrious. Mowat was always reliable in possession and his key in moving the ball, but here he was just noticeable for his out-of-possession efforts. Not an especially new debate is how Albion cope without Mowat, as he does not have a like-for-like replacement in the squad. The challenge is to have the 30-year-old playing as often as possible while working on the influence of those in midfield around him. Winger Johnston was at his electric best against the visitors from Lancashire, even before his 40th-minute rocket to open the scoring. He was a real thorn in Preston's side with many runs and efforts in goal. Johnston thrives on confidence and he grew as the clash went on. He has twinkle toes that at his best will bamboozle any championship defender. Mason said afterwards, Mikey knows that I love him, along with all my players. The Johnston scorcher was something familiar from his initial loan at Celtic. He scored a nice goal against Portsmouth earlier in the season, and the challenge for all wingers is consistency. Mason's take was fascinating. He called for Johnston to start scoring the scrappy tap-ins more often. He said, he was pleased to see Johnson in the six-yard box at Norwich when Josh Major scored as Saturday's 25-yarder screamer. The goalkeeper's performance at Norwich recently spoke for itself when he turned into a star man performance in the 1-0 victory. On Saturday, the Academy graduate once again backed up his burgeoning reputation with a couple of key individual moments to help Mason's side to the points. He's 1v1... save from Moulitane Osmagic at 0-0 probably changed the game, and the flying late stop to keep out Jebberson. And this article supported by a photograph of Albion midfielder Alex Moat as he shone on his side star man during the victory over Preston North End. And this shows the football players on the pitch with the ball. Works trigger tram and bus disruption. Broad Street in Birmingham city centre is closed for roadworks. It will be closed until Thursday, October the 30th, leading to changes to the city's bus and tram services. The announcement of the closure was made by Transport for West Midlands, who warned that regular transport throughout the city would be affected during the period. Diversions have been put into place for usual bus and metro services, with the transport administrators warning to plan ahead before travelling. More information can be found on the Transport for West Midlands website. Blind patients able to read with an eye implant. Developments represent a paradigm shift in artificial vision. People who lost their vision because of a common but untreatable age-related condition are now able to read again thanks to a pioneering electronic eye implant. The tiny primer device is just 2 by 2 millimetres and has the thickness of a human hair. Fitted under a layer of light-sensitive tissue in the eye called the retina, it allows patients to see letters, numbers and words through an eye that was previously blind. Some can now even do crosswords and read the tiny text on prescriptions using the so-called prosthetic vision. This breakthrough has never been achieved before and represents a paradigm shift in artificial vision, the experts have said. They are also hopeful that the technology could one day be available on the NHS. The world's first trial involved 38 patients across 17 sites in 5 countries, including the UK, France, Italy and the Netherlands. All had a condition known as geographic atrophy, GA for short, which is in an advanced stage of dry age-related macular degeneration, which is AMD for short. AMD causes the changes to the macula and the central part of the retina, which plays a key role in sight. GA, which affects about 5 million people globally, can progress to full sight loss as the central macula melts away. Experts estimate that around 1 in 4 people who are legally blind in the UK have GA from AMD. Those involved in the study had lost the central sight in the eye, been tested, and had only limited peripheral vision remaining. The procedure took place at Moorfields Eye Hospital in London around 3 years ago in under 2 hours. Surgeons removed the clear jelly-like substance from the inside of the eye, which is known as a vitrectomy. The trapdoor under the centre of the retina was then created, where the tiny 2x2mm chip was posted. To see words and write, patients wear augmented reality glasses, which contain a video camera. This is connected to a small computer attached to their waistband, which includes a zoom feature to make text bigger. The video camera in the glasses projects scenes as an infrared beam across the chip, which activates this device. Artificial intelligence in the waistband computer then processes the information, which is converted into the electrical signal. This signal passes through the cells into the retina and the optical nerve into the brain, where it's interpreted as vision. Mahi McQuitt, senior vitreoretinal consultant at Moorfields Eye Hospital at the UCL Institute of Ophthalmology, said that this has been life-changing for patients. I have these patients who are blind, and when you see them, they want to know there is anything that you can do to restore their vision, he said. And the answer has always been no. We've got some patients who are now reading books, their quality of life is much higher, and some of them are writing, doing crosswords and puzzles and things that they enjoy again. The chip has activated about a month after the operation, with patients then undergoing intense rehabilitation to help them interpret the signals and learn to read again. Sheila Irvine, one of Moorfield's patients who took part in the trial, now reads her prescriptions, does crosswords and reads the ingredients on tins. She said that prior to the operation, her vision was like having 2 black discs in her eye with the outside distorted. There was no pain during the operation, but you're still aware of what's happening, Miss Irvine added. It's a new way of looking through your eyes, and it was dead exciting when I began seeing a letter. It's not simple learning to read again, but the more ups and hours that I put in, the more I pick up. The developers of Primer, US-based medtech company Science Corporation, are now working to secure regulatory approval for the device. Mr. McQuitt said that he's hopeful this kind of technology could one day be available on the NHS. I would have to say it's as a whole paradigm shift, he said. He talked to the surgeons in the UK and colleagues that I'm with, and they're all really excited that this particular technology, it will be scalable. And this article is supported by a photograph of Sheila Irvine, who's been trained after having her new electronic eye implant that enables people to see again. And Sheila is sitting in front of a computer screen with all of the technology, wearing her glasses, and you can see her looking at the screen. Pub can reopen after licence suspended. A pub will be allowed to reopen after its licence was suspended for failing to call 999 following a stabbing. The Railway Inn in Harwood Street, West Bromwich, can reopen after the suspension of its late-night licence was lifted by Samwell Council after a review hearing last week. The venue's licence was suspended on September the 18th at the request of West Midlands Police in a behind-closed-door meeting over concerns that staff failed to notify the emergency services over a stabbing involving some of its patrons earlier that month. The region's police force said that it had reached an agreement with the pub owners ahead of the council hearing, which could allow the pub to reopen if it receives the blessing of councillors. A number of conditions were added to the licence, in which included banning alcohol from being taken outside after 9 p.m. The pub would also have to install noise monitors and limit music to a volume agreed with the council. Outdoor speakers would also be banned, and doors and windows at the venue would have to remain closed as much as possible. Samwell Council's environmental health team also supported the review of the pub's licence, saying it had received 26 complaints about the venue in the last 5 years, including 5 this year. The complaints said the venue was frequently home to events which saw reggae DJs performing on a makeshift stage, with cars and motorbikes racing in the street and blocking roads and pavements, as well as frequent arguments, fighting and littering. Call to be considerate with fireworks. Samwell Council is urging residents to use fireworks safely, responsibly and considerably this autumn, as fireworks season begins with the celebrations such as Bonfire Night and Diwali, as well as other community events. Fireworks can be an exciting part of seasonal festivities, but they can also cause distress to pets, wildlife and vulnerable residents. The council is encouraging everyone to think carefully about how and when and where fireworks are used, opting for quieter, low noise options wherever possible, and always putting the safety and respect for others first. Following a motion passed last December, put forward by members of council's Animal Welfare Task Force, firework displays are no longer permitted on council-owned land or other public spaces across Samwell. In line with this policy, the council says it's working with local venues and organisations to discourage traditional loud firework displays. The council is also reminding residents that it's illegal to sell fireworks to anyone under 18, and enforcement teams will be working closely with the police and trading standards officers to crack down on illegal sales and the misuse throughout the season. Councillor Suzanne Hartwell, Cabinet Member for Community Safety at Samwell Council, said, "Fireworks can be a fantastic way to bring people together and have been a traditional part of many celebrations, but we have a duty to use them responsibly. I know from my personal experience, we've had in West Bromwich fireworks going off at 3 a.m. lately, I think for the Diwali celebrations. So not everyone sadly is being considerate."
Welcome to the Sandwell Talking News Halloween Quiz. Question 1. Halloween comes from an old Celtic festival that marked the end of harvest and the start of winter. But what was this festival called? Beltane, Samhain or Lunasar? Question 2. Before pumpkins were used in Britain, people used a different vegetable to make lanterns. Which vegetable was it? Question 3. Trick or treat became popular in Britain after World War II. Which country did it come from? Question 4. There is a famous piece of classical music used in Disney's Fantasia where ghosts and demons dance on a mountain. What is it called? And for a bonus mark, who composed it? Question 5. In 1992, the BBC scared a lot of people with a live show from a haunted house in North London. What was the show called? Question 6. Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas is a popular Halloween Christmas crossover film. Who is the main character who steals Christmas? Question 7. In the Black Country, there is a story about a ghostly woman who haunts the tunnels under Dudley. What is she called? Question 8. In the 1970s and 80s, people from the Black Country told ghost stories near a dark hill with caves and tunnels. What is the name of this spooky place? Question 9. In 1996, this movie became the highest-grossing slasher film in the world until the release of Halloween in 2018. What is the film series called? Question 10. In the video game Luigi's Mansion, Luigi explores haunted houses. Which famous Nintendo character is Luigi's brother? How's your Halloween knowledge? Click to the answers to find out. Here are the answers for the Halloween round. Question 1. Halloween comes from an old Celtic festival that marked the end of harvest and the start of winter. But what was this festival called? Beltane, Samhain, or Lunasar? Samhain. Beltane is May Day and Lunasar is the harvest. Question 2. Before pumpkins were used in Britain, people used a different vegetable to make lanterns. Which vegetable was it? Turnips. Question 3. Trick or treat became popular in Britain after World War II. Which country did it come from? America. Question 4. There is a famous piece of classical music used in Disney's Fantasia where ghosts and demons dance on a mountain. What is it called? And for a bonus mark, who composed it? Night on Bald Mountain by Mussorgsky. Question 5. In 1992, the BBC scared a lot of people with a live show from a haunted house in North London. What was the show called? Ghostwatch. It was a scripted drama investigation presented by Michael Parkinson, Sarah Green, and Mike Smith, who all played fictional versions of themselves. Question 6. Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas is a popular Halloween Christmas crossover film. Who is the main character who steals Christmas? Jack Skellington, the Pumpkin King. Question 7. In the Black Country, there is a story about a ghostly woman who haunts the tunnels under Dudley. What is she called? The Grey Lady of Dudley Castle. Question 8. In the 1970s and 80s, people from the Black Country told ghost stories near a dark hill with caves and tunnels. What is the name of this spooky place? Wren's Nest. Question 9. In 1996, this movie became the highest-grossing slasher film in the world until the release of Halloween in 2018. What is the film series called? Scream. Question 10. In the video game Luigi's Mansion, Luigi explores haunted houses. Which famous Nintendo character is Luigi's brother? Mario! Thanks for joining me in this week's quiz. I'm Sarah Ann, and I'll be back next time. Bye!
TNS Soundings.
Hi, and welcome to Sound and Vision with Bob and Jill.
This time, we're in the Alexander Stadium in Birmingham for the National Tournament of Showdown.
We're out on location.
We are indeed.
And there's lots and lots of people here having a tremendous time.
The competitions are taking place in separate rooms, but we're at the moment sat in the practice room where people are warming up before their match.
It's really very interesting and it's quite invigorating, actually, the game. It's played at a pace.
Jack will start the ball. Jack's first serve, the score is 0-0. Danny, are you ready?
Yes.
Jack, are you ready?
Yep.
I'm Tommy Britton, the UK Showdown head coach. I coach at a club in South London, Croyshop Warriors, and I've been involved with the sport since its inception, really, into this country.
So where did Showdown begin?
Showdown originally began in Canada. Showdown is one of these things, it's instant adrenaline, and you kind of instantly get addicted to it. When you play it, sometimes it can be overwhelming, but then you walk away from the table when you think, I want some more of that. You know, if you are sort of sportsly in your lifestyle, Showdown still offers you a different set of skills that you're going to need.
And it's good for all ages.
Yep, so it's good for all ages. The youngest player I've had on the table is 7, and the eldest is 76, I believe. Anybody can play. Yeah. And in this country, we allow sighted people to play as well, alongside VIP people, because we all wear shades to level the playing field, first of all. But actually, if you're visually impaired, you're so used to tracking your ears and using audible cues, I don't want to say that we have an advantage over the sighted people. So we play with a lot more poise and precision than those with first sight. And I think if you play somebody of your own level, it's so comparable as well. Like, it's so accessible to everybody.
So you just need the table and you need a bat and you need the glove. Yep. And the shade.
And that's it, yeah.
Yeah.
So again, the shades are available online. You can use loads of different types. If you play in competitions, you've got to have sort of the goal fix ones are the best ones. But the referees will check, and as long as you can't see any light, they're absolutely fine. The gloves, we just use field hockey glove, but anything with a bit of padding is absolutely fine. The ball is like a hard plastic with ball bearings inside. And then the bats are just simple wooden bats. They look like mini cricket bats.
So if someone joins the club, they don't need to buy a vast amount of expensive equipment?
Not at all, not at all. A lot of clubs can provide the equipment, so you can just borrow the clubs when you turn up. And then if you want to get serious after that, there's a wide array of bats and gloves that you can sort of start getting yourself into if you really want to. But again, even that doesn't need to be expensive.
The table is roughly slightly longer than a table tennis table.
Yep, the tables are 1.2 metres wide by 3.6 metres long. So we have a centre board that goes right across the centre of the table. That's raised 10 centimetres off the table so that the ball can travel underneath. So the idea is to hit the ball along the surface of the table, underneath the screen, and then score in the 30 centimetre opening, which we call a goal, to score your points.
And how high is the, can I call it a wall, the surround round table?
Yep, I haven't actually measured that one, but I believe it's 20 centimetres. It might be 25 centimetres. And the curved edges that make sure the ball stays in play and stays mobile for as much as it can.
So how do I score?
To score, it sounds simple. You just drop the ball into your opponent's goal. It's just that easy.
Right.
Knock the ball up the table and hopefully it drops into the goal for 2 points. However, there are a lot of fouls in Showdown. And if your opponent commits one of those fouls, you can gain 1 point for each of them.
And the fouls are?
There's a long list, but most of them are intuitive. I've mentioned the ball has to go underneath the screen, so if you hit the screen or go over the screen. We play one-handed, so if you put your other hand on the table. Foul serves, like long serves and short serves.
So what skills does a person playing Showdown develop?
So tracking is probably the number one skill that you would develop, especially on an acute level. Orientation and using different things like spatial awareness, for example. So the goal line is tactile, so you can feel that. And having that awareness to know where you are in relation to that goal line or where you are in relation to the side walls as well. I'm going to say hand-ear coordination, because hearing where the ball is and then controlling the ball.
It's definitely keeping the brain active.
Yes.
So we're talking to David, and David's part of the team from Galloway's in Preston in Lancashire. So how did you get involved with Showdown, David?
So the opportunity came up when Galloway's were offered one of the
tables from the IPSA Games. Basically, since the first session that we had, just to see whether people would be interested, the group that we have at Galloway's has just flourished and become a great place for people to play showdown, talk, associate. Like, I've met some good people through the group myself. So I'm a volunteer player, tea maker, all the rest of it.
Somebody has to make the tea.
So yeah, it's a great social event as well.
It is, yeah. So what I've found when coming to national tournaments is the social aspect of showdown. You know, people are coming, having a laugh. When I come to a national tournament, it's still a really good hubbub atmosphere, but as soon as you start playing, you are having to be as professional as possible. Whereas when we play at Galloway's, we're just there for a bit of fun. Some of the players and the characters that are there, it's just fantastic. And showdown is just such an accessible game. It's just fantastic for everyone.
If somebody was sat at home and they wanted to socialise a bit more or get involved in a hobby,
yeah,
you'd say, well, it would be a great way. You can probably hear in the background that we're in the practice room at the moment.
Yeah.
And there's lots of laughter too.
Yeah, yeah. But the serious aspect of it, does it spark the adrenaline inside to play?
The social aspect, like I said, I think that is, especially when playing at, say, Galloway's or other clubs, that's what it brings together. As you say, you can hear the laughter, you can hear the social aspect going on, even at this level. And that's because we're all on an even keel. Like, as soon as we put blindfolds on, nobody can see anything.
So if you have some residual vision, you wear a blindfold, and that means you're playing without any sight at all.
So even if a doctor says that this guy cannot see at all, still have to wear a blindfold, just to make sure that there's no uneven competition.
And is it very competitive?
Oh, it is, especially at national level. So far today, I've played against one of the national players, so one of the people who play for Great Britain. And it's a baptism of fire, I would say. But it's really enjoyable, and I've learned so much just from that match. Like, I did score a goal against him.
Brilliant.
So that is good.
Well done. Yeah.
That is fantastic. Well done, yeah. But there's still a lot to learn. And things like this, showdown, is just fantastic.
So coming to the national tournament wouldn't put you off to come into another national tournament?
No. Myself, Peter, also from Galloway's, met up with some of the Sheffield group last night, went for some food, and we're doing the same again tonight. So there's such a social aspect that just makes showdown a fantastic community.
And it's only when you actually get to the table that the seriousness starts.
Exactly. Yeah. And then it's all seriousness, no smiles.
But highly competitive.
Oh, extremely highly competitive. But no, it's really great. I really enjoy it.
Danny, how did you find it the first time you did it? What was the initial reaction?
Loved it, as I expected, and was awful, as I expected. I set myself very high standards, so I came away, obviously, naturally disappointed that I wasn't running before I could walk. It was great, and there are many aspects. There's, if you are competitive, there is the competitive side of it, and trying to be the best you can be. You know, if you want to be the best in the world or go and play international tournaments, you can. But equally, if you just want a chance to go out and meet people, have a bit of fun, but test yourself at the same time, something out of your comfort zone or something that's different, you've got that environment where you can, you know, you can push yourself as far or as little as you want. It's all on me how far or how not far I want to go on a given week. You know, if I'm having a bad week psychologically or physically, I just don't go to training. It enables you to find your own place and your own level without being forced into something. So it depends what you're there for. If you're there to whack a few balls and get some excess energy out or frustration, then, you know, you can use it for that. And if you want to learn a wider range of techniques, then fill your boots.
You mentioned before the social aspect of the game.
Definitely, yeah.
So many people have said that
they have.
When they're away from the table, the social side is absolutely brilliant. Of meeting different people from obviously different areas around the country.
Yeah, and, you know, different walks of life, different experiences. Every individual is unique by definition. And obviously, with the growing number of people playing the game, for whatever reason or in whatever capacity, and also the fact that the game can be played by sighted people under shades only at certain levels, so there are certain tournaments where they wouldn't be able to enter, incorporate the wider world into your own life. That also then, vice versa, encourages more sighted people to feel comfortable around people with a hidden or obvious condition because they learned that, you know, how people work, what people are capable of and what they're not. And the fact that everybody is different, just like every sighted or physically able or psychologically able person is different. Every totally blind, every partially sighted person is different, especially with partial sight, because of the range of different conditions you can have.
That's a good point, actually.
Absolutely brilliant point, that, Danny.
Well, we're all the same and we're all different.
Absolutely.
My name's Sam. I played Showdown down on the south coast in a town close to Brighton called Worthing. Started up the club along with some help down there. First tried it end of 2023. British Blind Sport do these things called Have a Go Day, where they have different sports that you can try out. And I was looking for something to kind of invest my time into, really. I only lost my sight about 3 years ago. I used to play a lot of table tennis and didn't even know what Showdown was. Until I turned up, it was actually the thing I was least excited to go see on the day, but turned out to be the thing I enjoyed the most when I was there. We finished that Have a Go Day. I pestered my charity and said, how do we get a table? Posted up in the charity ever since. I'm there pretty much two times a week, and I go up to Croydon every other week and try and get as much time on the table as I can.
It made the adrenaline surge then.
Yes.
You felt, from going back to your sighted days when you were playing table tennis, did you find a similarity? Or?
Yes. It gives you that same kind of competitive feel and hit all the boxes of getting that same competitive edge, really. And like even when I play, Tommy's coached me a few times. He always tells me to stop shaking because my adrenaline's so high.
It's great that you can feel the adrenaline. It's doing you good as well. And, you know, obviously you're smiling when you're telling us what you're doing. The social side of it, do you find?
Yes, it's great. We started up a club down by a local charity, and we've been getting a steady stream of people trying it out. And if somebody likes it enough to stick around, then they're coming every week, and you get that like community feel, really. And coming to these tournaments as well, like we had a little road trip to come up here today, so there was five of us in a car, and it was it's just such a nice environment, really. And like even when you're playing, you're very competitive, but as soon as you stop playing, shades come off, you're shaking hands and smiles all around, really. And even if you lose, never really feel too bad when I lose a game.
Can I ask you, do you try and visualize where the ball is, or do you do it by sound? You said you'd only lost your sight 3 years ago.
I'm kind of a little bit of a mixture. I think I'm moving more towards doing it by sound. I try and picture the table when I'm standing at it, and because I've been around the table quite a lot, and I've put it together and taken it down, so I know the rough dimensions. So when I'm standing at one end, I am trying to picture where the screen is and like where I need to serve.
Is there a different noise on the sound wall from the centre of the sound wall halfway down the table to the end?
So the ball, you can kind of tell where the ball is hitting. So very good players can tell where you're moving the ball around. They'll pin it to like either left or the right wall and then move it into the middle of the table, and somebody would be able to track that. But yeah, when it bounces at their end, at the middle of the table, coming down to you, it's all different noises, and it all leads to different shots.
It sounds very technical.
Yeah, it's just so much brain power, really, to think about what the ball's doing, what you need to do, how you're going to block the shot, what they're doing on the other side.
What a brilliant time we had in Birmingham.
Yeah, we did. It was fantastic to learn about Showdown and to chat to everyone there. It was great to experience the fun and the laughter and to see this amazingly fast and adrenaline-fueled sport.
We'd like to thank British Blind Sport for their hospitality, and to Tommy, David, Danny and Sam for sharing their insight and passion for the sport of Showdown.
Now, if you'd like more information about Showdown and the clubs to join, you can go to the British Blind Sport website, which is britishblindsport.org.uk. That's BRITISHBLINDSPORT.ORG.UK.
You've been listening to Sound and Vision with Bob and Jill. We'd like to wish you all the very best and ask you to take care. So until the next time, it's goodbye from the both of us.
TNS Soundings.
Calling notice, Sandwell Visually Impaired CIO SVI Annual Forum and AGM on Monday the 17th of November 2025 from 9:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. We are pleased to invite you to our 21st annual forum to be held on Monday the 17th of November at the Portway Lifestyle Centre, Newbury Lane, Albury, B69 1HE. We welcome Mayor of Sandwell, Councillor Steve Melia, who will open the day. Guest speaker is Barry Lane, who will talk to us about his life and times as a visually impaired person and his goal ball success. Transport can be organised for you to get to the event and lunch is provided. There will be a range of interesting exhibitors for you to visit during the day and a raffle will be held to raise funds for SVI. After lunch, you can browse the stands or just relax and chat with friends. If you would like to attend, please complete the enclosed booking form and return in the free post envelope by Monday the 3rd of November. The annual forum also provides you with the opportunity to take an active part in our work by standing as an SVI charity CIO trustee. To find out more and to make a nomination, please see the enclosed trustee nomination form. We hope you'll be able to join us. A warm welcome awaits you. The SVI team.
Thank you to all the volunteers, James, Alison, Lauren, Sarbjit, Jenny and Kate. Thanks to Sarah Ann for doing the quiz, a Halloween edition this time. Thanks to Sue for picking the articles everyone's read. To Sairita for uploading everything to the website and the podcast. And to Ray for producing everything. Also to Tony and Gavin for putting everything onto USB sticks and CDs for us and sending them out in the post to you. Enjoy Halloween. Have a lovely week.
Thanks to you, Pam. You're the remaining one to thank. Two things to mention. First, the podcast I mentioned last week, of course you can find it by searching for Sandwell Talking News. I've found that Sarita seems to get that done by Friday lunchtime. So you should get the podcast and probably the live feed for the streaming Talking News, where you can listen track by track from around Friday lunchtime. The postal edition usually reaches people around Saturday, at least we hope, but post can be vague and probably especially coming up to Christmas. Now, the Broad Street work on the tramway is very much a thing at the moment, as I've noticed going along Broad Street, not least because I haven't as yet found a safe crossing place. All the crossings seem to have been barriered off, at least as I speak. It can be tricky crossing Broad Street, so if you happen to be in that area, you might call on help to get across Broad Street, which obviously can be quite busy. The buses are still going along Broad Street, although at certain times, particularly late at night, I think they get diverted down Sheepcote Street along to Spring Hill and that way onto Great Charles Street. These works won't be going on later than the end of this month, I'm glad to say. I don't know what disruption might be caused at the Wolverhampton end, but I note that some of the trams have been going to St George's again as well as to the train station. So don't get caught out by that. I don't know if you'll be going out much these next few days, but it's very windy today. And for the next day or two into the weekend, perhaps, the weather forecast does look to be calmer from around the middle of next week. That is it for this week. Do get the pen drives back to us as quickly as you can. But for now, bye-bye from me, Ray, and all the team for this week. And we'll be back with you next week.
To use our talk phone service to listen to Sandwell Talking News or leave us a message, phone 0121 699 6696. If you are using a landline in the 0121 area, then just dial 699 6696.